Good Sunday morning and welcome to another edition of the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Camerton. And this programme is brought to you in part by the generous contribution that we receive from the Irish Village Group of Companies and also the Monterey Inn Resort. Today's programme we're going to share with you a lecture that I attended when I was at home recently in Carrick and Shannon on a book that was written by Dr. Miriam Moffat called Supers and Jumpers, and it's dealing with the effort to convert people in Connemara between 1849 and 1937. But before we get to that, I want to fill you in on some of the stuff that's going on here at the weekend. Later on this morning, if you are interested and you're a youth between 6 and 15 years of age, the Ottawa Gaels youth training goes on at the Oz Dome from 11 till 1. And of course, there's Irish language classes going on weekly, provided by Cultus Cultoriairn, and that's on Wednesdays and Thursdays, and they're at the University of Ottawa with Sheila Scott. And there's a music session down at Rushing Doves on Monday nights at 9 p.m. and Tuesday, of course, the Irish Society Seniors Drop-In is ongoing at St. Margaret Mary's at Sunnyside in Fairburn. And I noticed this week on Tuesday evening, the Ottawa branch of the Ontario Geological Society Irish Research Group gets together at McNabb Community Centre at 180 Percy Street. If you want music, you can go down to the Heart and Crown. I've noticed there's music down there every night of the week now. And there's also music between Wednesday and Saturdays at some of the other pubs that are part of the Irish Village Group of Companies. There's a winter celebration with Searson down at St. Bridget's on Friday evening, and that starts at 7:30, and Margaret Moriarty was the lucky winner of a pair of tickets from last Monday night's show. And Margaret, I hope you enjoy that concert down there. And the Ottawa Gaels have their indoor football, Gaelic football, on Friday nights at 9 p.m, and that's at the Algonquin Dome. And I'm looking forward to the Ottawa Gaelic football banquet on Saturday night. Tickets are from Bill Wright at 613-226-6637 if you haven't got them. And that's at St. Bridget's at 314 Patrick Street. And this year, the Gaels are going to select a contestant for the Rose of Tralee pageant, which will be held in May here in Ottawa. And the girl will be selected for that, and she'll go forward to the Rose of Tralee in August. It's the first time Ottawa will have its own rose in the International Rose of Tralee Festival, which is celebrating 50 years this year. And I see also that Patrick Eaton and Laura Byrne have a traditional Irish tune, song and story session out at Claire Dwyer's place at 1414 Sheridan Rapids Road in Lanark. And we have to remind you, of course, Rasheen are in concert at Library and Archives Canada on the 16th of March, a concert at 7:30. You can get tickets for that at ticketweb.ca or the Ottawa Folklore Centre. And the Festival of Irish Music is on March 10th to launch and get the Ottawa Irish Festival underway. But first we're going to talk to John B. Kelly about his new production, Doubt, which opens at the Gladstone this coming Wednesday. John, welcome back to the Gaelic Hour.
Thank you, Austin. As you know, I love being with you.
Well, I'm always delighted to have you, and particularly for the amount of work that you're doing in theatre. Were something we all have to be very proud of is your contribution to theatre in Ottawa.
Thank you, Austin.
Doubt. What I want to put you about it in brief, if you just give me a very quick summary of what the storyline is.
Sure. Well, this is John Patrick Shandy's very, very famous play by now. You know, John Patrick Shandy's father emigrated from Westmeath, so that's the Irish link in it. But anyway, he sets this in New York in 1964, and it's a conflict between a nun who is trying to bring down a priest for a very serious crime without any evidence whatsoever. And the great, marvelous thing about the play is that that particular question is not answered, and you're left in doubt at the end. The play itself, of course, is about a lot more than that, but it's a fascinating piece. And they say that in Broadway, audiences were actually fist-fighting outside the theatre, and that's, on Broadway, as to who was guilty and who's not guilty, that sort of a play.
John, to put on a production like Doubt, particularly after it has been in the cinema very, very recently, did that present unusual challenges to you?
Well, yes and no. You know, when people told me, you're mad, it's in the cinema, it's there, I'd say, listen, you know, it's very hard to get the word out that we're around. And this is, as far as I'm concerned, it's getting the play, the doubt into people's minds. And I think someone who sees it as a film would be more tempted to go see it as a play. And I think people who see it as a play would be more tempted to go see it as a film. It's a different medium, very different. It's just a great piece of entertainment. And I'm not worried about that. I'm actually, you know, people say to me, oh, aren't you worried that Mary Ellis will be compared to Meryl Streep? And I say, yeah, it's very unfair on Meryl Streep, isn't it?
Indeed. Indeed. So, John, you're opening on Wednesday.
I'm opening on Wednesday, and we're running for 2.5 weeks, as usual, in the Gladstone Theatre. And as I say, it's a marvellous piece of entertainment. And besides that, it'll really move people because it asks some very serious questions.
And we're going to play a little snippet from the play. And if someone wants to get tickets, do you have the number off the top of your head?
I do. It's 613-233-4523. 613-233-4523. Or you can actually get them on the internet directly at thegladstone.ca.
John, thanks a million for coming back on the Gaelic Hour, and I wish every success with the production.
Thank you, Austin.
Thank you, Sister James. Sister James will be co-directing the pageant with Mrs. Shields this year. So what do you think, Father Flynn? Is there something new we could do?
Well, we all love the Christmas hymns, but it might be jolly to include a secular song.
Secular?
Yes. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Something like that.
What would be the point of performing a secular song?
Fun. Or Frosty the Snowman. That's a good one. We could have one of the boys dress as a snowman and dance around.
Which boy?
We do tryouts.
Frosty the Snowman espouses a pagan belief in magic. The snowman comes to life when an enchanted hat is put on his head. If the music were more somber, people would realize the images are disturbing and the song heretical. It should be banned from the airwaves.
So, not Frosty the Snowman?
I don't think so. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas would be fine, I suppose. The parents would like it. May I ask what you wrote down with that ballpoint pen?
Oh, nothing. An idea for a sermon.
You had one just now?
I get them all the time.
Unfortunate.
I tend to forget them, so I write them down.
What is the idea?
Intolerance.
Now, when you get to on a sermon, don't you put on show enough with an Italian show, Miriam Moffat. Now, Miriam Moffat is after writing Supers and Jumpers, the Protestant Mission in Connemara, 1848-1937. Very few of us realised that it went on to 1937. You're very, very welcome here.
Thank you very much for coming. Yes, this book is Supers and Jumpers. It tells the story of the Protestant missions in Connemara. It's a very, very interesting story. This organisation, which we're going to talk about, called the Irish Church Missions, they were established at the time of the famine, and they continue to the present day. They have changed their focus entirely. They have taken the words, they were called Society for Irish Church Missions to the Roman Catholics. They've taken the words to the Roman Catholics out of their title. They now just work as a city centre mission, and they do fabulous work. Very, very grateful to them. They gave me entire free run of their archive. Whereas, when you listen to this tonight, you're going to be horrified at the things the mission did. You're going to be equally appalled at the things the Catholic Church did in response. Neither church at this comes out of this story covered in glory, but you've got to cite the events in the time in which they happened. About 150 years ago, there was no grey areas. Everybody was absolutely convinced that their religion, and only their religion, was right. Catholics were convinced that Protestants couldn't get into heaven. Protestants knew well that Catholics couldn't get into heaven. There was just no two ways about it. And religion was a much more central thing. The reason I think it was much more central was that people knew that there was a good likelihood that they could die any time. Looking around now, we are all pretty sure that we'll see Easter or we'll see summer. In those days, if you got an infected cut, you'd get septicemia and be dead within a week. So religion was a much more central thing in people's lives. So having said that, you'd have to cite the events that happened in the time that they happened. This was the Irish Church Missions, and it was founded by Reverend Alexander Dallas. He was an English clergyman. He knew nothing about Ireland, and he definitely did not know how the poor people, the peasantry of Ireland, thought. He definitely had no clue about the Irish psyche, and he was a military man. So he approached everything with a very sort of a statistical, regimented mind, and he didn't take into account how the Irish peasantry might have thought. So the story takes place in Connemara. Reverend Dallas, before the famine, he had decided that the Catholics of Ireland needed converting. And in fact, he was already undertaking work before the famine, but he was running out of money. And the reason why the Irish Church Missions wanted to convert the Catholics, at the time, scriptural Protestantism, evangelical scriptural Protestantism, they felt that there are practices in the Catholic Church that have no basis in the Bible. So you have veneration of Mary, veneration of scapulars and sort of religious objects. You have transubstantiation. Those were the two major things. So these were non-scriptural practices. The other reasons that they wanted to convert the Catholics of Ireland, which they never acknowledged openly, there was political reasons, sociological reasons, ethnological reasons, because if you remember, this is 1845 or so, just the start of the famine. You're not too far away from Catholic emancipation in 1829. You're still only not even 20 years. You're only 10 years away from the campaign to get rid of the tithes. So they were very, very wary and very frightened in England of the power of the Catholic clergy in Ireland. And they thought if they could eliminate that, if they could convert the Catholics of Ireland to being Protestants, well, then they would eliminate the political power of the Catholic clergy, which they were very frightened of. And they also, at the same time, as the famine is going on, and you have hundreds of thousands of Irish pouring into English cities, and they're the poorest of the poor, a lot of them don't even speak English, they have no respect for authority, the only people who keep any control on them at all are their Catholic clergy who have followed them over from Ireland. So the equivalent would be if hundreds of thousands of illiterate, unruly Muslims pouring into the US, who had no respect for law and order and authority, couldn't speak a word of English, and were only answerable and only took control from the mullahs that followed them from Iran. That's the sort of mindset that you had at the time. But at the time, Catholicism was seen as a big political conspiracy. Like, bigger than a religion, it was a political movement, in the same way as some people see Islam as a political movement. So there was this same hysteria about trying to control it. They had this idea that if you have these hundreds of thousands of Irish peasants pouring into the English cities, wouldn't it be a great idea if we could convert them to Protestantism before they come over? And then, instead of being a drain on our English cities, they're going to be an asset to the English cities, because they'll already be nice, good, scriptural Protestants. And with that, they presumed that equated to being lawful, industrious, well-behaved citizens of the empire. They thought that the two obviously went hand in hand. So they could colonise and civilise the barbaric Irish. So these were the reasons why they wanted, as well as being a religious, hidden underneath it, and never said out explicitly, but it was definitely there. There were political and social movements as well, because they thought if they could convert the Irish Catholics, as soon as you convert them into scriptural Protestants, all of a sudden they become loyal, they become... the Irish problem is solved, the economic problems of Ireland is solved, all this insurgence and uprisings and all that will all be solved, because they're all going to, immediately, when they take off their Catholic hat and put on their Protestant hat, that immediately not just changes their religion, but changes their identity, their political beliefs, their ideologies. And they were so convinced of the reason to do it that at their annual meetings they used to make these extreme statements, like the guy who says, "It's a war of extermination, and so it ought to be, for the conquest is between truth and error," and the whole place breaks into applause. It's the sort of genuine conviction of the need to convert the Irish. As I say, Dallas set up this fund to convert the Irish. The Fund for the Spiritual Exigencies of Ireland was called first. Then they put the new handle they put on it was Society for Irish Church Missions, which is a more manageable title to call it. And they set it up initially in a small little place called Castle Kirk, which is sort of near to Man Cross in Connemara. So Dallas goes down there. It's the height of the famine. People are dropping down dead. The famine in Connemara was pretty dreadful. He has a lot of money, and he sets up these schools, church services, and there's food distributed at them. So everybody flocks along. He gets enormous attendances. At the time, there wasn't any national schooling in the Diocese of Tuam. John McHale didn't approve of the national school system. So even though we had national schooling in Aconry and Killala and Elphin, you didn't have this in Tuam. So in the very area which was very, very poor, and the people couldn't fund their own education, there was no education, because John McHale thought the people would lose their religion if they went to national schools, and they'd lose their national identity, that it would make them into good English citizens. So he forbade the opening of national schools within his diocese. So when the Irish Church Missions come along and they open up schools, of course the people flock to them. And the fact that there's food handed out and the place is in the middle of a famine, people absolutely flock to them. So from where Castle Kirk was, actually the people that went to the mission came from the whole way around there, and they used to travel by water. Had the same thing when we get over to Clifton and around there as well. Before you know it, he has about 8 schools dotted along there, right around the lake. Within about a year or so, the whole of the area has converted. And Dallas and his followers are writing glowing reports about how the people have seen the errors of Romanism, embraced the scriptural truth, and they're coming out of the darkness into the light of the gospel. The mission sends out absolutely glowing reports that the whole area is absolutely converting like dominoes, which it was. Everybody was going to get food. So pretty quick after that, the message spreads and money pours in, absolutely. So that from about 1848, 1849, up to about 1854, you get enormous sums of money. In 1854, they got over £40,000. That's between 3 and 4 million in today's money. And they were able to extend the mission towards Clifton, mission schools and services the whole way over. And they did wonderful work. They fed the people. 1851 is the first year that we have actual numbers. But in 1851, they were feeding 10,000 people every week in Connemara, the majority of whom would probably have died. What they used to do was they set up schools, orphanages, three orphanages at Clifton, another one from Nadnafariga at Spiddle, and later on here at Linnan. They set up 64 schools. They used to go house to house with the Bible in their hand, encouraging the people to read the Bible. They also had the food in the other hand, so the people did listen to the Bible. They had controversial meetings. I'll tell you what controversial meetings were in a minute. They had schools for adults because the people were very aware that they needed to learn reading and writing and that they needed to learn English. And they also did Irish teaching, where they took their oldest school kids, they trained them up pretty fast. These school kids were told, go out and get 8 people. And this week's verse from the Bible is this, and they'd get a verse. And then they'd be examined at the end of the week, and then the school kids would be paid on results. So it was a little cottage industry. And the school kids were nicely paid on it. These school kids continued to be used as Irish teachers for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. And they were getting a fair bit of money. They were getting 2 and 3 shillings a week, which was a good bit of money back in the 1850s, especially when there was nothing else going. And the other thing they did was controversialism. Now, when we use the term controversial nowadays, it has a different meaning. When we say that something is controversial, we mean there's a bit of an issue about it. But in those days, controversialism meant if you have a strongly held belief in religion, politics, whatever, and if I believe something different, I will take your belief and I will tear it apart. I will insult it beyond belief. I will do the most incredibly offensive things about it. And then you will, of course, realise how wrong you were, and you will turn around and start believing what I believe. And that's about the most non-productive way of changing somebody's mind. So that this did say the most appalling things about the Catholic religion. For instance, they would have had huge devotion to Our Lady. I have found where one of the clergymen refers to her as a graceless whore. So, of course, what would happen is that the people took enormous offence and they beat up the scripture readers. And they used to get really hot and bothered about transubstantiation because the Catholic idea of the Eucharist is that it's a real presence in the Eucharist, and the Protestant idea of the Eucharist is that it's a symbolic presence in the Eucharist. When the priest would be in the middle of Mass and he'd be holding up the host and he'd be saying, this is my body, these lads would be down the back of the church and they'd be shouting out, if that's his body, can any of you see his legs? Can any of you see his arms? And of course what would happen is that these lads would get bent up. So this would happen the whole time. So I don't want you to get the idea that they were really nice, benign people handing out food to all and sundry, which they were. But they had their own agenda and they had their own methods which were appalling. Now, the counter methods were just as appalling. We'll get to them in a minute. They said that they never gave out a penny of relief. They didn't give out any food. They didn't give out any clothes. They didn't give out any anything. Now, the dogs on the street in Connemara knew that if you went to the mission, you got fed. You'd have to be blind, deaf, dumb and stupid not to know that if you wanted food, you went to the mission. But they said, we don't give it. And they put their hand on their heart and they put their hand on the Bible and said, not a penny of our missionary income is spent. What they forgot to tell people was that there was two parallel funds. There was a fund for missionary income, which paid the missionaries, and there was a fund for relief, which supplied the relief. So when they said in all of their publicity material, these people flock to our services because they're coming out of the light, darkness into the light of the gospel, and they now recognise the errors of Romanism because not a penny of our missionary income is spent on relief. The fact that they actually had printed receipts, and the fact that Fanny Darcy, who was the wife of the rector in Clifton, signed the receipts, it was definitely an established, recognised practice. And at this point, we've got to maybe think about the difference between English people and Irish people, because the English people genuinely wanted to convert them, they wanted to save their souls, And they used to get these magazines every month. There was two. There was one called The Banner of the Truth and one was called Aaron's Hope. These magazines that they used to get are very like the magazines my mother used to get, like the SMA or the Far East or whatever. I mean, there's not a huge amount of difference between them. And you'd get these magazines where you'd have maybe a picture of a school with an unpronounceable name, telling about the huge attendances you had and how you were having new people every week. And forget to mention the food that's handed out every week, the clothes that's handed out every week. The English people really, really, really believed this. They genuinely, and out of the goodness of their hearts, they contributed enormous amounts of money for the conversion of Ireland. I've come across diaries of English people who came to tour the missions. Connemara became a magnet for English people. Go on a tour and see the advances that are being made. And English people came along and they wrote these diaries. But they obviously hadn't a clue of what life was like on the ground. These were fairly upper-class English. And they used to look at these people. Now, you've got to think, in about 1852, the people had been through 4 or 5 years of famine, followed by another 2 or 3 years of cholera and typhoid. At this stage, they had sold everything that they had. They had sold their farm implements, the tradesmen had sold their tools. They had seen everybody around them drop dead, die or emigrate. So they didn't have either the means or the energy to lift themselves up. But the English people who came to look didn't see that, and they wrote in their diaries, these people, they're so lazy. They call them the lazy, degraded serfs of the Pope. And in Glan, Cardinal Paul Cullen, before he was cardinal, he was just Paul Cullen at this stage, he wrote a letter to Tobias Kirby telling us that 140 out of the 160 families in Glan had perverted. That was his term, not mine. That's the level of uptake that the mission had. And the Catholic Church was absolutely horrified because it didn't know how it was going to combat this. And what is going on in Connemara? They're getting so successful in Connemara that they're actually set up and they're doing the same thing up in Dublin, in the slums of Dublin. And they have plans to roll it out all over the country. And the Catholic Church doesn't have the money, it doesn't have the means at all to combat it. Each mission would have had 3 or 4 stations. And in each mission, you would have had 1 ordained missionary, 3 schools, with maybe at its height 2 or 3 or 4 school teachers in each school, plus 2 or 3 or 4 scripture readers. In the whole of Connemara, at its height, you had about between 300 and 400 mission agents going around. And when you get that amount of schooling, that is more or less carpet bombing the place. So that where the actual population of Connemara is, which is more or less mostly in a ribbon around the coast, and it's a lot less densely populated in the middle, those areas were very, very, very carpet bombed with mission schools. There was almost a school in every field. I did say to you that it had a civilising, you know, the sort of, we will convert the Irish and we will not only make them fervent scriptural Protestants, but we're going to make them civilised. You know? We're raising up the people and we're changing them ethnically as well. If you go around Connemara, if you ever drive around Connemara, if you look and you'll see lots of buildings, like national schools, but just not quite. The dimensions are a little bit wrong. They're the same shape as national schools, and they mostly have an eyebrows on the windows. They have a sort of a moulding around the windows. So you get this, you get a sort of a moulding around the windows. And when you see that, there's a lot of them converted into private houses around Connemara, and they were mission schools. So as well as establishing the 64 mission schools that we saw, they established 14 new churches, and then Oughterard, Ronstone and Clifton were already there, so they got enlarged. Going from Turnacheady is the most inland one, there was one in Castlekirk, and then you have that's Leenane, Renville, that's called Maillard, Salerno, Ballyconry, Omi Island. Most of them are gone. There's a few of them still in existence. The one at Leenane is still in existence. That was consecrated in 1853, about, or 55. But you couldn't get a bed in Clifton for the consecration of that church because there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of English supporters came over to witness the consecration of the first mission church. Balmahinch Church was this gorgeous little church, but it's now a Catholic church. And with all the tact and everything of the Catholic Church, having got this building handed over to them, which was a mission church, there's an enormous, huge, big stained glass window of the Blessed Virgin, which they could have done without doing. Where did they get their mission agents? And what did the mission agents do? Well, they got their mission agents from a number of places. To start off, for the first couple of years, they had to get mission agents from somewhere. So they got some from the Athol Mission, and they got some from the Dingle Mission, and they were very handy because they had the Irish. They got some from England, but they were not too useful because they didn't have the Irish. And some came down from the north, and they weren't all that useful either. So within about a year or two, they train up their first two classes of mission pupils. Essentially, these mission agents, they're employed and are very, very well paid. A mission teacher is paid €60, £60, £5 a month, £60 a year, which is an awful lot of money, because national school teachers will be paid £12 a year. So you get national school teachers then to sort of jump ship and become mission school teachers, because, I mean, it was a fivefold increase in salary. So you get this group of mission agents that develop. But what happens is that the mission agents, after the Catholic opposition gets going, life is not too nice being a convert. So the mission agents tend to marry each other, so they become a little self-contained bubble within the greater community of Connemara. And just if you take this guy, Thomas King, he actually had about 8 children, I've discovered since I made this. All but one married a mission agent. He was a mission agent, if you've ever read Doctor, a mission agent. So he was a scripture reader. His son, John, was a scripture reader. John married Anna Nolan, whose brother was a scripture reader, who was married to a scripture reader, whose sister was a scripture reader, who married a scripture reader. So you get the picture, it's just a little self-contained bubble. Now, I said that a big part of the mission's raison d'etre wasn't just the conversion. It was that you were going to change and you were going to solve the Irish problem. You were going to convert them into loyal citizens of the empire. So they used to produce these homes and addresses. So when all these English visitors came over, these youngsters from the schools would be trotted out to say the most outlandish verses, poems and addresses, which were then proof that they had changed, that they had become ethnically changed. And this is my favourite one. It goes, "Welcome to the Saxon here, whom once we learned to hate and fear, but now a free and happy band, we love and bless their noble land." And that's the sort of thing that the English supporters wanted to hear. They wanted to hear that, oh, we've solved the Irish problem, we've converted them, and they're now loving England, and they're not going to be any trouble anymore. And they used to put the most outrageous words into the mouths of converts. So the first convert that was buried in Derrygimla churchyard, he was buried in 1862. I haven't been able to find his name, but he was quoted in the Mission's monthly magazine as having said, now remember, this guy, he was a peasant from Connemara, whose first language was Irish. He was more than likely totally illiterate, but somebody is supposed to have said to him, "Will we send for the priest?" Because they always sent for the priest before they died. And he is supposed to have said, I hope I got it right, "No, don't bother sending for the priest. I renounced the wafer to follow him. Soul for the soul, the shadow for the substance. He is my all in all." And this is a guy who wouldn't have been able to string two words of English together probably, and he comes out with a really sophisticated theological argument. Another guy sort of said that he couldn't bring himself to go into a Protestant church because he would have had trouble doing that from the neighbours. But even though he hadn't bent his knee or he hadn't taken the wafer for so many, and he used to come up with these incredible theological arguments, and he used to put these words into the mouths of illiterate Irish-speaking people and then trot out what they had said. This is another one, examination at Castle Kirk School. There is Mr. Dallas sitting in his chair, and these are all the little kiddies from the school, and they're there. And they're in white pinafores. You know, you have them there, hands joined in prayer, white aprons, pinafores. This was about 1853. They wouldn't have had the clothes. Not only that, but whoever drew the picture, that's cropped. The whole picture is actually a lot bigger. And they were obviously told to draw the picture and put in the lake, put in the mountains, put in the church, put in the school, and they put in all the bits. But they were obviously not there because the bits are in the wrong places. There's nowhere where you can actually stand to recreate the picture that they made. They were told, draw a picture of children at the side of a lake with mountains and the sun and the church and the school. So they did. They sat down and they drew it. But they put the bits in all the wrong places. So it obviously wasn't a painting of an actual event. Catholic Church is absolutely losing its reason. John McHale is the Archbishop of Tuam, and he doesn't know what to do about it, so he really doesn't do too much. And Paul Cullen is the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, and he's the primate. Gets moved to Armagh there. And John McHale in Tuam and Paul Cullen in Armagh hate each other's guts. Paul Cullen represents the voice of the Vatican and all the power that's coming from Rome. John McHale represents the old style Irish church, we'll do it our own way. And this goes on for about 30 years, and it actually creates a schism in the church in Ireland, where the Irish church missions were actually able to exist because there was this power struggle, but they couldn't stand each other. Well, the first thing that happens is Rome orders McKay to open up national schools. He has to now open up national schools. He does it reluctantly and in a very small way, but he does open up national schools. They also establish St. Vincent de Paul societies and other forms of relief to hand out some other forms of charity to the people so that they wouldn't have to go to the mission, maybe. They also organise parish missions, which is, you know, somebody comes along for a priest's Vincentians or Redemptorists, or, and they'll stay in a parish for maybe 2 weeks or so, 3 weeks, and they'll have nightly services, and they went around, and when they did that then, they would have set up sodalities and confraternities as a spin-off of this. They also publicised in letters to the newspapers and in pamphlets what the mission was actually at, and that these enormous successes were really only because the people were starving, and they also publicised the offensive means of operation of the mission. But even more important than all of those, what the Catholic Church did was order total ostracisation of converts. If you converted, you were finished. Socially, you were finished. Nobody would talk to you, nobody would employ you, nobody would buy from you. If you took the soup, because the mission, when they gave out the food, the most food that they gave out initially was the soup, so that you were called a super if you took the soup, or you were also called a jumper. And we think that jumper, we're not certain, it either is because you jumped or you turned, either that, or it could be because jumpy sheep, a corruption of the word jumpy. Supers or jumpers were totally ostracised. You gave up an awful lot when you took the soup. In Connemara, down around Skull, down around Dingle, there's still connotations of, wouldn't they be supers? You'll still get comments. They set up national schools. To give you an idea of how much this place was carpet bombed with schools, that whole area is about 4 or 5 miles long and about 2 miles that way. So in an area about 5 miles by 3 miles, you have 8 mission schools, 5 national schools, 2 orphanages, 3 mission churches and 2 Catholic churches. I mean, that was more or less putting something in practically every field. The whole area was so polarised down the middle. You could not be neutral. You had to decide you were going one way or the other. Because this is the level, the intensity of missioning in both directions that the people got. Of course, the area had been neglected for years until the missions came, but then, as happened in Achill and as happened in Dingle, as soon as the missions came in, then there was a reaction and a response. So what happens then is that all these people were converted, and there were hundreds and thousands of people converted. And they didn't convert when times were bad, but one by one by one, they begin to come back and come back and come back. So by about the mid to late 1850s, about half of them have come back. So you get comments in the Catholic registers that two Hodgins, two children, who were baptised as Protestants in 1857, 1860, but they were baptised in the Catholic Church in 1862, and they were noted as jumpers. And you get the most horrendous comments in the Catholic baptismal registers when people come back. They were marked as jumpers. The other thing is that people were always baptised when they came back. If you were baptised by the minister, well, you got baptised a second time. Then, of course, when times got bad, you might go back to the mission and they might baptise you again. Then you might... Some people got water thrown on them 4 or 5 times. Every time you change from one to another, you got baptised this way, you got baptised that way. But while we think this is funny, and it is very funny, the parents of this boy in 1876, an adult, so he was born in 1858, they were old jumpers and had the child christened. These inverted commas are... This is all written in the baptismal register by the minister, yes, leaving the jumpers, and neglected to have Michael baptised until the present date. So at some stage between 1858, when he was born, and 1876, that family came back, and they forgot to baptise him a second time. So how do you influence a people? How do you stir up a people? Because remember, what the Catholic Church did, and the most successful thing, it wasn't the clergy that defeated the mission. The Catholic Church got the people themselves to defeat the mission. They got the people themselves to do the most horrendous things to converts. They burned them out. They beat them up. They wouldn't employ them. They did the most dreadful things to them. But how do you instill that sort of thing in a population which is mostly illiterate, can't read, so there's no point sort of putting up notices, putting it in the newspaper. Not even much point saying it at mass, because mass attendance was pretty bad. So how do you instill a contempt for the mission in a pre-literate society? But one of the things that they used was they dreamed of the most wonderful street ballads. Street ballads are fabulous because they're passed down from generation to generation to generation. Do you want even an example? of how good a street ballad is. If Father Murphy from Old Kilcarmack had been written up in the local newspaper, that would have been forgotten about a fortnight later. Somebody would have used the paper to light the fire. Instead of which, 200 years later, we all know about Father Murphy from Old Kilcarmack, and we know what he did. Or even more precisely, we know what the song tells us he did, which might be because he did so. Street ballads are fascinating in the way that they can influence people, and they can influence generations of people, and the people don't even need to be able to read. Children can learn them, and they can just be jingled out. And this song was picked up in 1937, which was 50 years after this particular guy died. He was a mission agent called McGovern. "That reprobate McGovern is too long in this locality, seducing Roman Catholics and leading them astray. Going to a dozen orphans with the Bible in his pocket, saying, deny the mass in chapel and a super he'll be made. The man that is in opulence should always place his confidence in the almighty providence and not be led astray, nor be duped like McGovern for 20,000 sovereigns, nor scandalise his family for his domestic sway." And the best ones of them all are in Irish. And in Irish they're absolutely brilliant. But I had to get people who were native to Connemara to read them, because I couldn't make head nor tail of them with book Irish. Because there's turns of phrase in them, Soup House Moyers, and the loose translation would be, "Oh, God forbid that anything would ever happen to Soup House Moyers, because it's the best thing that was ever set up around here." Now, if you read that with book Irish, you think he's praising it. But if you read it knowing the turn of phrase, you know that it's actually one in the eye. And it goes on and on and on. They set up these schools, they employed the youngsters, so that nearly every house had youngsters employed as Irish teachers. This idea of pretending that somebody was an Irish teacher was really just a way of paying the convents. You said, "I'll pay you to be an Irish teacher." Now, at this stage, there's no active mission work going on, but you're still getting your 3 shillings or 5 shillings a month for it. So you're going to stay with the mission. The other things that they do is they set up groups of mission cottages. And so that the people, and they still exist. If you're down in Ballyconeely, you can see a field down there with about the ruins of about 12 houses in it. Now, this is a chicken and egg situation. You can say they were bribing the converts by providing housing, or you can say that the converts were being bet up, burned out, and terrified to live beside their Catholic neighbours, so they were providing them with a place of security. Equally, when the Catholics said that they wouldn't allow converts on fishing boats because they were told it was all sorts of bad luck to have somebody who wasn't Catholic on your fishing boat, so then they couldn't get any employment as fishing. So then the mission went out and it bought 3 or 4 boats for them. So do you say that the mission is bribing them with boats, or do you say that it's providing boats because they can't go on the other fishing boats? Or do you say that, well, no, they know if they convert that they go out on the mission's fishing boats? So it's a real chicken and egg, and there isn't an answer to it. The Catholics were giving the converts an awful time. They really were giving them a dreadful time. And they were being bet up, they were being evicted. Catholic landlords would throw the jumpers off their property. Whether they owed them rent or not, they were evicted. Protestant landlords then next door would take them in. So what you really had was a form of ethnic cleansing, before we ever knew the word, where you got some landlords cleared their land of converts, other landlords preferentially gave farms to converts or took in evicted converts. So you ended up with clusters on this guy's land and none at all on this guy's land. So the Clarity family, anyway, of Albrecht, and they're evicted by Valentine Blake, who's a Catholic, because they're with the mission. And Mrs. Clarity says, when their bailiffs come and they're going to throw down her house, and she says, "No, go back, say that I love my Bible, my children love it, my husband loves it. Tell my landlord he can throw down this house and throw us and our children out on the road, but by God's grace we will not give up our Bible nor our Bible school." That's in 1859. So she says, "I'm sticking with the mission, that's it." But roll on 13 years. I was going through the Catholic Baptist directors. And Patrick McManus, the parish priest of Clifton, recorded that. "He baptized on the 12th day of April 1872 the following children of John Clarity and Emma Clarity in his sticker. All these were making with the lying, heartless jumpers, but when hunger and want had abated somewhat, they left the soup dens and left instead of their souls and bodies their heaviest crime. They are a true example of who all who went to the den," these words I can't read, "from the pressure of dire want. All these children were baptized the same day," and he names them. "This record will be a lasting testimony to the villainous hypocrisy of the supers. All these doings took place in the village of Albrecht." And the converts, when they reverted, were made sometimes come out in front of the whole congregation at Mass and publicly before the altar say that you were renouncing the errors of jumperism in which you never really believed. They did other dreadful things, like one poor guy, John Howell, up at Omi Island, and he was dying and he sent for the priest. Because the best thing that was considered was to live a Protestant but die a Catholic. So, but sometimes it's about the timing a little bit, they cut it a little bit too tight. So John Howell sends for the priest, but he dies before the priest gets to him. Now, they've been a long time with the mission, this family. They've been about maybe 30 years with the mission. So poor Mrs. Howell is there, and she's got her husband dead, but she wants a Catholic funeral, or he wanted a Catholic funeral. And the priest says no, and the whole thing is put in abeyance for 3 whole days, because the priest orders a boycott of the funeral. None of the neighbours would be allowed help, nobody would be allowed to do anything, until Mrs. Howell and all the adult children get baptised. Now just think of the shame, and the, at the very time that her husband has died, and this poor woman with herself and her adult children have to publicly be baptised, and then he consents and goes ahead and marries the old man. Another one that we get is the Hollerans. These two lads were baptised, teenagers at least, when they were baptised in 1876, and the comment is the parents of these baptised children were seduced by the filthy jumpers. But when you think of the Hollerans, and I thought initially, oh yeah, they must have become converts early on, and then after 10 or 20 years they decide to go back, but you discover no. And this is the funny thing that I found. It wasn't just the people sort of flooded to the mission in the bad years and then trickled back over the next 20, 30, 40 years. People went out and came back and out and came back for about the whole of the 19th century. Because if you look at the Hollerans, they baptised 3-4 children in 1863, 65, 68 and 71. Then the next child, she gets done twice. She gets baptised a Protestant in February and a Catholic in the following July. And then they continue on with Catholic baptisms. But the children are still in the Protestant school. They used to pretend to convert. I thought initially that it was going to be, everybody went to the mission between, we'll say, 1848 and maybe 1855, and then you get a trickling back then over the next 20, 30 years, but you don't. You get them going out and coming back and going out and coming back. And this coincides with bad harvests, it coincides with maybe a change of landowner and a rent raise, and it coincides with any period of want. They go out and they come back. Just like their picture of Castle Kirk, with the little ones standing like that with their pinafores on and everything. This is the picture of Derry Gimlet Church, which gives you the impression that it was a huge, big church. In actual fact, it was the exact same size as Erislannon. It was a small little mission church. It wasn't that shape at all. It was only knocked down in about 1955, so there's loads of people around who still went to that church, and I showed them that picture, and they also not look like that at all. Roderick Ryder lived in the rectory. Roderick Ryder was a colourful character. He started off life as a Catholic priest, and he was a Catholic priest in Lisconnor, County Clare, where it's still Slate. And he was moved from there to Crockwell. And after he moved to Crockwell, he found himself in a little bit of a pickle because his housekeeper from Lisconnor followed him with a bump. And the story gets very, very funny at this stage. He said it wasn't his. He even tried to pin it on his parish priest. I mean, it's actually very, very funny. In Crockwell, you're in the Clonfert Kilmacdua diocese, so the bishop is down in Gort. So the bishop in Gort, Bishop French, he holds a diocesan inquiry, and everybody is saying it's Roderick Ryder's. Roderick Ryder saying, that's not something myself. He had been ordained in America, and the bishop says to him, what's the best thing you can do, Roderick, is just get yourself back over to America, out of my hair, just disappear up to America, I'll give you grand reference, just go. He says, he's not going anywhere. And he says, just go. No, he's not going anywhere. So he decides, instead of that, he'll become a Protestant missionary with the Irish Church Missions. And with all the tax that the Irish Church Missions have, they decide that the best place that they'll put him back to work is back into his parish of Crockwell, where he knows all the people already. Like, I mean, this shows you how much they knew about the Irish psyche. So they decide to put him back into Crockwell. So he lands back in Crockwell. He's about as welcome now as a plague. When he converted, the Galway Mercury wrote a piece about the nature of his conversion and his suspension by the bishop and his housekeeper and all this. So he decides he's going to sue the Galway Mercury. It turns into a huge, big libel trial, For he's represented by Isaac Butt, incidentally. It just meant that I was able to get the details of the trial. If he hadn't sued, I'd never have known any of it. So now you've got pages and pages and pages of the details of the trial. Anyway, he's not having much success in Brockwell, and after a year or two, they decide to move him over. And he spends the next 30, 40 years in Derry Gimlach. So the Irish teachers, they started off, 450 people were being paid about 5 shillings a week or so. So there were 450 families, you can say, being kept going. And then it goes down and down and down and down and down, and they sort of taper off. At one stage, they were getting enormous successes over in Connemara. They really were. Like, I mean, 3/4 of Connemara had converted. They'd only converted because they were hungry, but they'd converted anywhere. They were at least going to the mission. So Dallas is going over, and he's telling Dallas, the guy who found it, and he's telling London audiences that Ireland is now 50% Protestant. Now, it was all right for them to say, they could have said Connemara was 50% Protestant, and they could have been right. It could have been more than 50% Protestant. But to say that Ireland was 50% Protestant, and it was always, we're just on the cusp. Just give us once an extra little bit of money and we'll just finish the job. And this, they kept this up until about the 1920s, 1930s. And if you tell somebody what they want to believe, tell somebody that your money isn't being wasted, look, we're very, very successful. So they got the first cohort. They got the youngsters who went to school. When they opened up in 1848 until the national schools were established in about 1855, that age group. And they retained a lot of them. Not all of them, but they retained a lot of them. And they died off then, about 1920, thereabouts. They didn't get the upcoming generations. So, the upcoming generations, some of them reverted to Catholicism, but some of them stayed Protestant, but they had to emigrate because Connemara wasn't a good place to be a Protestant in, to be a convert Protestant in. Because time and time and time again, you see that the Catholic community of Clifton seriously differentiated between what they called original Protestants and what they called mission people. And they had all the time in the world for the people who were originally Protestants, but the people who had converted, they had no time at all for. So if you look at the way the mission is, when the folklore was collected in 1937, the mission was well bet. We also were in a free state. There was a folklore, there was two types of folklore taken up in 1937. There was the school's collection was taken up and actual folklore collectors went around. It was, at this stage, 90 years after the famine. And when you ask somebody for their memories of the mission, you're not actually getting the perception of people at the time. You're getting the views of an elderly person looking backward. It's probably more a reflection of the 1937 attitudes than it was of the reaction 50, 60, 70 years earlier. So you've got to bear that in mind. The Quijan and Sassney, a Grinch, Munch, Boys, and Tedder, and the Dini Bukta. Bar the Quijan and the Dini Boss, all the Chinook, Trust, and Mim, Boys, and Tedder, Glasgow, a Dubby Quijan and the Dini Sassney, Chin and Tom, or Dumpy and Kachiki. Some Englishmen were giving yellow meal and clothes to people. There's another one. In the Protestant age, Jane of Oranua, the top of these mean then, they now dump off in the Protestant. So, Protestants were making a new road and they gave meal to anyone who would turn Protestant. Now, this is a very important thing. It's firmly believed in Connemara, or it was at this time, that the mission was government backed. The mission wasn't government backed. In fact, the government knew that the mission was just stirring up major trouble and causing strife. But if you have a landlord who one minute is in charge of the government relief programme on a Monday, and on a Tuesday he is a mission supporter and he's handing out meal or he's whatever, the people on the ground didn't see the distinction between it. The fact that some of the landlords were both involved in mission relief and in famine relief, they didn't see the difference, and they couldn't be expected to see the difference. And the Catholic, Irish Protestant population wanted nothing to do with it. The Irish Protestants and most of the Protestants in Clifton were saying, for God's sake, will you please just shut up shop and go home? All you're doing is causing major trouble for us. And you'd have like a one state commission trying to set up in Kilkenny, and the Kilkenny Protestants pleaded with their bishop to try and get the mission workers out of the area, that all it was doing was causing trouble for the Protestant community. In general, I don't think that the people thought at the time they were bad people, that they were, but it was easy to say it when they were well bet 80 years later, and when the climate in the country had changed. So just to finish up, I don't want to give you the idea that everybody who became a Protestant eventually came back to being Catholic. Because since I published the book, this John His family, he subsequently, this guy, and William King, worked for the mission until about 1880. They both went off and got ordained. They became Church of Ireland clergymen. His family lives down in Kerry. His family moved to Australia, and his family moved to Connecticut. Two of them who went on to produce generations of clergymen, and they have stayed absolutely firmly in the Protestant faith, and lots of others did too. Just not in Connemara. They had to go. But so I wouldn't like to give the impression that the mission didn't have success. It just didn't have success in Connemara. So that's it.
Dr. Moffat, that was a fantastic lecture this evening, and most educational and entertaining. If somebody wants to get their hand on the book, where can they get their hands?
It's published by Nonsuch Ireland. So if you go onto the website, which is literally www.nonsuchireland.com, you can buy it online from there. They have an online ordering system, so you can get it from there.
And there's no problem shipping it across?
No, not at all. No.
Excellent.
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. It was a fantastic night.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed it.
To the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cameron. This programme will be available on the internet later on in the week, and I want to thank the Irish Village Group of Companies for their ongoing support, and also the Monterey Inn Resort. If you want to reach me, my email address is austin@thegaelichour.ca, the website thegaelichour.ca. Don't forget Roisin in concert March 16th. Library and Archives Canada tickets are available for that on ticketweb.ca or at the Folklore Centre. And also a Festival of Irish Music on March 10th, including Ceisl Lyra. Tune in tomorrow night for a music programme here back on Chin 97.9 FM at 10 p.m. And again next Sunday morning, where we will have another magazine show for you. So until then, this is Austin Cameron saying thanks for listening. Slán go fóill.